apologies for our delay. We were conferencing on the previous case. Our counsel ready to proceed in Coleman v. State, case 65724.
Okay.
All right, go ahead, Ms. Restrepo.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Hardesty, Justice Pickering, Justice Sada. I'm Deborah Westbrook from the Clark County Public Defender's Office on behalf of the appellant Michael Colvin. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Okay. Initially, I would like to thank this Honorable Court for ordering an oral argument in this case after taking the case under submission a year ago. The appeal raises some very interesting and important jury instruction issues, including whether a Mendoza-type instruction is mandatory in a kidnapping incidental case, whether a Clay instruction is mandatory at trial when the state is alleging child abuse based on a non-accidental physical injury. The appeal also calls into question this court's pre-appointed jurisprudence that the date of a child's sex offense is not an essential element of the crime. And finally, the appeal challenges the constitutionality of the coercion statute when applied to individuals responsible for supervising children. But before I get to these issues, the court has directed the parties to address whether each of the counts of appellant's conviction are supported by sufficient evidence. So that's where I will begin today. Michael Colvin was convicted of 13 counts, one count of lewdness with a child in count two, one count of first-degree kidnapping, which related to the lewdness count, and that's count one, 10 counts of child abuse, neglect, or endangerment, counts 13 through 22, and one count of non-sexual coercion, which was count 23. And in our opening brief, we were challenging the sufficiency of the evidence for 8 of the 13 convictions. At page 21, we challenged sufficiency of the evidence for count two, lewdness with a child. At page 29, we challenged the sufficiency of the evidence for count one, kidnapping. And at page 32 through 34, we challenged the sufficiency of the evidence for 6 of the counts of child abuse, 15, 16, 19, 20, 21, and 22. And because the court has asked for supplemental briefing specifically relating to the child abuse counts, that's where I would like to start. Our sufficiency of the evidence argument with respect to the child abuse counts was premised on this court's decision in Clay versus 8th Judicial District Court in 2013. And Clay held that whenever a child abuse charge is based on a non-accidental physical injury, as was alleged in this case, physical injury is an element of the offense. And contrary to what the state argued in their supplemental brief, it's not enough for the state to merely introduce evidence of a potential for a physical injury. They had to show an actual physical injury since the crime that they were alleging was based on a theory of non-accidental physical injury. Clay further held in this type of case, a grand jury must be instructed on the definition of physical injury because that's a technical definition that is much narrower than what a layperson would commonly understand that term to mean. And under Nevada's child abuse statute, physical injury requires proof that the victim suffered either a permanent or temporary disfigurement or impairment of any bodily function or organ of the body. Clay also held that in this type of child abuse case, without some testimony about, quote, the nature or extent of any physical injury, there would not even be slight or marginal evidence of child abuse. So based on Clay, it's our position that the judge had a duty, sua sponte, to instruct the jury about the statutory definition of physical injury, even if the parties did not ask for the instruction.
And even if they stipulated to the instruction, isn't that what happened here? The parties agreed to the instruction that would be given absent the Clay requirement.
Which would have lowered the burden of proof on an essential element, and I don't know that there was ever a voluntary waiver by Michael Colvin to give up an essential element of the state's case. But if the state is required to instruct the grand jury on the definition of physical injury, the same rule has to apply when the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt, certainly. So the way our sufficiency of the evidence argument came up in the opening brief was when we were explaining how the instructional error affected Michael's substantial rights in this case. And if you look at our opening brief at page 32 through 34, we went into great detail to show that there was no evidence of any physical injury for six of the 10 child abuse counts. And because the jury convicted of Michael of the 6 counts of child abuse without any evidence of physical injury, we were asking for a new trial based on an instructional error. Unfortunately, the state's answering brief misinterpreted our Clay argument as that we were challenging just the 6 and not all 10. But in fact, we were challenging all 10 of the counts. If you look at our argument summary at page 15 of our opening brief, that's where we state explicitly Michael's convictions on count 13 through 22, child abuse, neglect, endangerment, must be vacated because the jury was not properly instructed on the elements of those crimes. So in our opening brief, we were addressing all of them. Some of the clarity may have gotten lost because we had to condense our brief from 17,000 words to the 14,000 words after we filed a motion to exceed the page limit. So it might, some of the clarity might not have been there, but we were, in fact, challenging all 10. So we left our reply brief. We pointed out the state's misunderstanding of the argument, and we clarified that the proper remedy for the error, whether that be a new trial versus an acquittal, was going to depend on whether or not there was any physical injury evidence as defined by the statute. And since the state had conceded at page 32 of their answering brief that no precise physical injuries had been testified to for 6 of the 10 child abuse counts, we pointed out that it would violate double jeopardy principles for Michael to be retried on those 6 counts. And that was based on this court's 2011 decision in Stevens, which outlined the sufficiency of the evidence test and explained, you know, when you would either get a retrial or have the counts vacated. So it's our position we weren't really making a new argument in our reply brief, because it was always our position that the state had failed to prove, you know, those elements. There was no testimony. We were just simply clarifying the misunderstanding and then explaining what the proper remedy was going to be. And since the court has given the state an opportunity to respond both in a supplemental brief and hear oral argument, I don't think there's any reason why this court can't consider right now whether retrial is barred on those 6 counts. The court can always address plain error or constitutional error sua sponte. And for the remaining 4 child abuse counts, it's our position that a retrial on those is still necessary, because we already know if the jury found Michael guilty of child abuse on 6 counts where there was no evidence at all, we know they weren't considering physical injury as it related to the remaining 4 counts. And that should have been submitted to the jury. The jury should have had an opportunity to decide beyond a reasonable doubt whether...
So your point is the 6 counts should be eliminated altogether because of the failure of proof and double jeopardy attached, they can't be retried, but the other 4 are subject to retrial?
Yes. The other 4 would have to be retried because...
And was this case tried before Clay? It was, correct?
No, it was tried after Clay. And actually, the interesting thing is that the state actually instructed the grand jury on Clay. So the state was aware of the responsibility to instruct
Clay. So the plain error, it was
absolutely plain error. And yeah, defense counsel even, because there were actually 2 separate cases. One was, one was originally brought by a complaint, and then there was a preliminary hearing, and a motion was filed based on Clay.
Yes. Okay, thank you. Yeah, so it was on the books.
So unless the court has additional questions about our position as it relates to the 10 child abuse counts, I'd like to move on to the sufficiency of the evidence for count 2 release. In Apprendi versus New Jersey, the United States Supreme Court held that the 6th Amendment jury right requires a jury to find, beyond a reasonable doubt, every fact that increases the penalty for a crime beyond the prescribed statutory maximum. And 13 years later, in Alene versus United States, the Supreme Court extended Apprendi and ruled that facts that increase a person's mandatory minimum must also be submitted to a jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And as a result of those 2 cases, any facts that increase the severity of a mandatory sentence are considered to be elements of the offense that must be submitted to the jury. So, for instance, if a criminal statute were amended on a particular date in a way where that date increased the severity of a mandatory sentence, it would follow that the date would constitute an element of the offense that would have to be submitted to a jury under the Apprendi Alene jurisprudence. Turning to NRS 201-230, Nevada's lewdness with a child statute, the date of October 1st, 2003 is very significant. Because on that date, the mandatory sentence for lewdness with a child was increased from 10 to life without the possibility of parole for people who had prior sex offense convictions like Michael. And to this day, the life without is the mandatory penalty for prior child sex offenders who were convicted under that date, or under that statute. So the date of October 1st, 2003 is really the demarcation line when the penalty changed. It's our position that under Apprendi and Alene, the state was required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that count 2 occurred on or after October 1st, 2003, because that was the date that the penalty increased. Now, unfortunately for Michael, the jury was not asked to make that factual finding beyond a reasonable doubt. First of all, the indictment that the jury received alleged that the crime alleged in count two was committed between February 2005 and February 1, 2013. Secondly, jury instruction number five, which defined lewdness with a child, didn't mention the date being an essential element. Third, we have jury instruction number 10, which actually told jurors that when a child does not remember the exact date of the act, the state is not required to prove a specific date, but may prove a time frame within which that act took place. And then finally, during closing argument, the state emphasized that particular jury instruction, reminding the jurors that they weren't required to prove a specific date. So we know that the jury was never informed that the date was an essential element, and we know they didn't consider it as an essential element because LH actually testified that count two occurred when she was, quote, around seven. And LH was seven between February 2, 2003 and February 1, 2004. And even the state conceded at sentencing that based on LH's testimony, the crime had to have occurred around 2003 or 2004. Yet, the jury found that count two occurred in 2005. So right off the bat, we know that there was an Apprendi error and that Michael could not properly be sentenced under either the 2003 or the 2005 statutes. But to answer the court's question about specific sufficiency of the evidence, we're also arguing that based on the testimony that was given, no rational juror could have found beyond a reasonable doubt that count two occurred on or after October 1st, 2003. So first of all, we have LH testifying that she told her mom about the initial incident, the dryer incident, the same day that it happened. And then we have LH's mom, Amy, testifying that she first learned that LH was being sexually abused when she was five or six. So if we believe Amy's mom, that first incident, the dryer incident, occurred sometime between February 2, 2001 and February 1, 2003. Both dates well precede the amendment to the statute and would have been under the 1999 lewdness statute.
So you would agree that if we agree with that point, the Apprendi argument is unnecessary? Because your client would have been or should have been sentenced under the 1999 version of the statute.
I don't think that the Apprendi argument is unnecessary. Apprendi really explains when you have a right to have an element submitted to the jury. And in this case, that element wasn't submitted to the jury. So it's not simply a matter of, you know, vacating what's an illegal sentence. His trial is fundamentally unfair because as Apprendi and Aline define the essential elements of the crime, they're anything that increases the mandatory sentence.
But isn't that what occurred in 2003? There was no provision in the 1999 version that would have invoked an Apprendi argument, was there?
I would say that the only statute that could possibly apply to him or be applied to him would be the 1999 statute.
Right, which would not have required an Apprendi determination.
Well, as it was submitted to the jury, what the jury ultimately found and what he was sentenced on was it was a crime that occurred between 2005 and 2013 at the time when it couldn't, we know that the facts don't support that. But one of the things the state is also saying is that, she said she was around seven, so that could have meant eight or nine. By that same rationale, she also could have been five or six, and it's more likely that it's five or six given the mother's testimony that she first heard about this, when LH was either five or six. So essentially, the state hasn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime occurred on or after the date of that statute. And the state makes a big deal about the party's agreement at the sentencing to basically apply the 2003 and 2005 statutes, and they argue that the claim that this error was invited. But unfortunately, the error occurred at trial when that essential element of that date was not submitted to the jury, so the jury didn't have an opportunity to make the required factual finding. Under this court's ex post facto jurisprudence, you can't apply a statute to somebody, for an act that was committed at, before the statute was introduced. That's the Goldsworthy versus Hamilton case. And so the district court would not have had jurisdiction to impose the sentence that it did. Despite no matter what the parties argued at the time, it wasn't in the court's power to even entertain those arguments. And there is a case, the Abrego case, where this court did find a waiver of an Apprendi issue. But in that case, the defendant had actually filed a pretrial motion asking for the issue in question to be removed from the jury. And over the state's objection, the court granted it and took it away from the jury on the defendant's affirmative request. In this case, we didn't even, you know, there was no notice. I mean, we had the issue of the indictment being defective. We didn't know this was an issue until after. And it appears that trial counsel wasn't even aware of the issue at the time that he was making his sentencing arguments. So this is not a case where there was an affirmative request to have something done that was that could have altered, that actually would have affected the court's jurisdiction. So that's my time.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Luzich.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the court, my name is Lisa Luzich. I represent the state of Nevada, and I was trial counsel. In fact, not only was I trial counsel, I had the case from its inception. I'm the one who went to preliminary hearing, and then I'm the one that went to grand jury as well. Michael Colvin is an individual who tormented the Holston children, and in fact, their mother, for a period of 15 years. He physically and sexually abused London Holston, he physically abused Christopher Holston, and he physically abused their mother as well. He is a convicted sex offender, and at trial, Mr. Draskovich and I went out of our way to not allow any of that information to come before the jury, recognizing that it was prejudicial and this court's position on prior sexual acts coming before the jury. So a lot of things that happened in this case happened tactically for that purpose. As far as the Apprendi argument, I have to disagree completely with appellant counsel. The defendant can't, or the appellant can't now come and make this kind of argument because trial counsel not only didn't object to the sentencing under the 2003 statute, trial counsel told the court, you must sentence under the 2003 statute. And the reason trial counsel told the court, you must sentence under the 2003 statute, was tactical. In 1999, granted, there was no life without the possibility of parole for prior sex offenders. But in 1999, the only possible sentence for lewdness with a minor was 10 to life. In 2003, the court had three options with which to sentence a lewdness with a minor conviction. 2 to 20 years in prison, 10 to life, or life without. So trial counsel made the tactical decision to say, no, you must sentence under the 2003 statute, and he argued for 2 to 20 years in prison. That is a much more palatable argument and sentence for a defendant than, oh no, you have to be sentenced to life in prison with parole eligibility after 10 years has been served. And in fact, the 2005 statute, because the complaint or the indictment was charged on or between 2005 and 2013, the statute as it was amended in 2005 also only provided for 10 to life or life without the possibility of parole. The only time that counsel would have been able to argue for a sentence of 2 to 20 years was under that 2003 statute. The defense is still claiming that if the jury had the ability to, or that we don't know whether they found beyond a reasonable doubt when the offense occurred, I disagree. The jury, by their verdict, found beyond a reasonable doubt that the offense occurred between February of 2005 and February of 2013 because that's what the indictment charged. Defendant keeps talking about how, about how London said, well, it happened for the first time, that dryer incident, when she was around 7. Well, she was 17 when she was describing what happened 10 or so years ago. Around 7 doesn't only mean in the calendar year that she was 7. Around 7 means it could have been when she was 7, 8, 9, or whatever. The jury, by their verdict, found that it happened within 2005 and 2015. This court has found that
on several occasions that age or the date that it occurred, I should say, is not an essential element of the crime of lewdness with a minor, of sexual assault, in fact, also. Therefore, it is not an Apprendi issue. He was sentenced appropriately under the 2005 statute, or sorry, under the 2003 statute. I've told this to a different panel of the Supreme Court before, and I share this with you. Sex offenses are different offenses. Children victims of sex offenses and physical abuse are different kinds of cases. The court can't necessarily look at sufficiency of the evidence in a sex case the same way the court's going to look at sufficiency of the evidence in possession of stolen vehicle or a drug case or a robbery. If somebody is held up at gunpoint, of course they're going to report that right away. If somebody is the victim of a sex offense, especially when it's a child, you can't say what that child is going to do unless and until you've been in that circumstance yourself. So when people say she should have reported right away, if it really happened, she would have reported right away, or if it really happened, she would have given all the details the first time, that's an argument that just can't be made in a case involving sexual and physical abuse of a child. Justice Seda, I know, has presided over trials where during jury selection, a juror has said, for the very first time ever, I was a victim of sexual abuse and I've never reported it. And I know that because I tried a case like that in front of Justice Seda. So people who are victims of sex abuse don't necessarily report it right away. So when we're talking about sufficiency of the evidence of the lewdness count, and the defense at trial is going into all of the inconsistencies and not being reported right away and not describing it the same way all the time, it doesn't mean that it didn't happen. It just means that that's how London Holston dealt with it. London tried the best she could to describe what happened. And remember, when you have to describe something like this, if you're held up at gunpoint, you give a statement to the patrol officer, you testify at preliminary hearing, you testify at trial. When you are a victim of a sex abuse, sexual abuse, you tell the first person whom you disclose to, then you have to give an interview to somebody else, then you have to give an interview to yet another person when you're having your physical exam, then you go for a pretrial, then you testify at a preliminary hearing, then you testify at trial. The last two times you're actually describing what happened in front of the person that did this. And remember, during the trial, even Mr. Draskovich described for the jury, look at him sitting here, he looks mean. Imagine how he looked to London. A jury is sitting there thinking he looks mean. Imagine how the child who had been through this abuse felt as she was sitting on the stand and trying to describe it, first for a judge at a preliminary hearing, then for the trial. So when you're looking at sufficiency of the evidence, and you hear things like, well, she was upset because he took away her phone, or she was upset because he took away her car, or she was upset because he was cheating on her mother, it doesn't mean it didn't happen. Those are just instances that, yes, now is the time that she described it, because the way she described at the preliminary hearing and at the trial, she had enough. Enough was enough. She was finally in a place where she was safe. She was at the hospital, and she was able to, for the first time, talk about it. If you remember, during her direct examination at trial, there was a time that I actually asked her, are you okay? She was crying during her testimony. I asked her, are you okay? And she said, yeah, it's just really hard to talk about this stuff. Because he's sitting there, looking her in the face, and he was looking mean, which we know because even his attorney said that. And that's what had happened at the preliminary hearing. She was testifying in front of him. He was giving her those looks. And she just couldn't talk about it anymore. That she didn't get any of the sex.
Counsel, I've tried a number of child sexual assault cases. Some as counsel, but most as a district court judge. I have no doubt that the pressures of the courtroom, the presence of the defendant, will influence a victim and add pressure to their ability to describe what transpired. What concerns me in this case, though, is the court is left with the testimony that they offer. And when you look at the sufficiency of the evidence when weighed against the Clay instruction on at least those six counts, there's a problem. I would like to hear from you on those six counts.
Absolutely, Justice, and I'm sorry, and the reason I was bringing up that sex abuse and physical abuse is different is it's one thing to look at a cold, hard transcript, but it's something else entirely, as you know, because you've tried these cases, to see the victim testify, which is why I would submit to the court that a jury's decision as to sufficiency of the evidence is very important to take into consideration rather than just the trial court.
Well, right, but in the context of these six counts, the thing that's troublesome is the jury didn't have the definition of the physical injury in front of them. So even if the jury was inclined to believe that the victim in this case was harmed to a point that would have justified sufficient evidence for physical injury, the record doesn't make that very clear, and quite frankly, the supplemental brief submitted by the state isn't of much help either, because you simply send us back to what you said in your answering brief. So, you know, we're at oral argument now. How do you address the sufficiency of evidence if this court finds that there is a violation or an omission of the Clay requirement and the elements of the crime?
I would first suggest that the defense did stipulate to those instructions. The defense is stuck with the stipulation to those instructions.
That was my point with counsel. I'm troubled by that, for sure. I don't believe that the defense can stipulate to the omission of an element of the offense. And Clay certainly seems to present an element to the offense in those six and probably ten counts. Would you agree with that? Do you agree that Clay imposes on those ten counts an element that requires a definition of physical injury?
I suggest that in Clay, it's the court said that, because the court was talking about the grand jury, and the court said in Clay that pursuant to the statute 172.0952 that says you have to instruct at grand jury, that in the grand jury proceedings, you must give the instruction. And I did. I did give that instruction in Clay, and I have to admit, I thought that I used the same instruction in trial that I used in grand jury. I did not realize until I read the briefs that I didn't use the same instruction. I would suggest, however, that in those counts, there was still evidence of physical injury, and the jury could have found so had they been instructed. Count 15 was the throwing the tools at London, and she described how he threw the crescent wrench at her and hit her, and it hurt. In count 16 is the smacking.
Let's take count 15 as an example and just test that against the Clay requirement for defining physical injury. That requirement, and I believe instruction you used at the grand jury is, the physical injury requires an impairment of bodily function or organ of the body, or a permanent or temporary disfigurement. What is it about the throwing of the tool and the testimony about that in count 15 that satisfies that requirement? I mean, that's what we were looking for in the supplemental brief.
Okay, when he threw the crescent wrench at her and it hit her, I thought she had testified that it caused a bruise, but my notes do not reflect a bruise. It was the extension cord that had the red mark.
Well, let's take the extension cord. Even if that produced a red mark, is the red mark within the definition of physical injury that includes a permanent or temporary disfigurement? So you would, I guess, argue that a red mark satisfies a temporary disfigurement.
Yes. A red mark or a bruise is a disfigurement of the body. Mm-hmm.
As to any of those counts, you're not suggesting that the acts that were described in response to those would result in an impairment of bodily function. So you're focused on whether they satisfy temporary disfigurement in each case?
A temporary, or count 19 is the count where the defendant would strike repeatedly Christopher Holston on the head with the knuckles. Christopher described how it gave him bad headaches often, impairment of a bodily function.
So you would say the striking on the head and giving bad headaches would be impairment of organ of the body? Or
that's how I would argue it.
Okay.
Count 20, hit them or snap them both with the 2x4. That was really painful when he would snap them. That would be a stretch, but I would try to argue that that was an impairment of an organ. Count 21, throwing the tools. He didn't say that it was. There was a bruise. Count 22, telling Christopher Holston to slap London. They both described how it would leave red marks, and they would suggest that that would be at least a temporary disfigurement. So no, not on all of the counts would I be able to demonstrate that there was either a permanent or temporary disfigurement or an impairment of the organ, but on three of them, I would.
Can you give me the three again that you were contending you were able to, that there was some evidence?
Well, three of the ones that you had pointed out on count 13, repeatedly striking London on the head with the knuckles, and Christopher Holston repeatedly striking him on the head with the knuckles, is count 19, the headaches. Count 14, whipping London with the extension cord, the headaches, temper, or impairment of an organ. Count 14, whipping London with the extension cord, she described the red mark, it stung and felt really bad, temporary disfigurement. Count 17, London described, and Christopher also testified that he kicked her in the back with the boot. London described that it gave her a bruise. She couldn't walk for several days because it hurt so bad. I would suggest that that's both temporary disfigurement and impairment of an organ. Count 18, choking Christopher Holston. He had him, both London and Christopher described, he had him up against the wall by his neck. Amy, the mother, described the red marks that she saw on his neck thereafter. I would suggest that that's temporary disfigurement. We said 19. Repeatedly having Christopher slap London and leaving red marks, again temporary disfigurement. I think still that because the defense stipulated that the counts, if the court were to reverse, should be able to be retried. Obviously, I'm hoping the court is not going to reverse. I don't know if I've passed my time. Does the court have further questions?
I do not, Justice Pickard. Do you have any questions?
I do not.
Okay, thank you.
I thank the court for their time. We would ask the court to not reverse the conviction.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So in listening to the state's argument about counts where there was what she claims sufficient evidence, the only one of the six that that I had been arguing about that I heard her reference was count 19. And she said that that's the one repeatedly striking the said CH about the head with his hands and or fists. And based on the state's argument, headaches satisfies the permanent or temporary disfigurement, impairment of any bodily function or organ. And I'm just not sure how she gets there. It's the same as saying that something was painful. It doesn't show there's no disfigurement. She doesn't show how the brain was impaired, how thinking was impaired, how any function was impaired. There's really nothing that gets you there for the purposes of count 19.
Ms. Westbrook, you had exhausted your time during the regular argument. I know we asked you some questions, but I did want to give you a moment because counsel also ran over in her argument to address what she was talking about and how she responded with respect to the clay impact based on the evidence that was produced. So unless you have anything else you'd like to add there, I'd like to conclude the argument then. Okay, thank you both, counsel, for your excellent arguments and your briefing in the case. The matter will stand submitted. We appreciate your input.